Mr. Duffy, I understand that you took your first two degrees, your BS and your MS, at Rensselaer Polytechnic. And I'm a little bit curious about what brought you to Wisconsin for your PhD.
Well, I had the happy accident of being sharing an office with Joel Hogan, who was on the faculty at RPI at the time. Joel was the brother of Olaf Hogan. Olaf Hogan was on the faculty here. Olaf is one of the, what should I say, the grand old men of chemical engineering, one of the really outstanding figures. He was then and is now. And Joel said, look, you ought to go on and get your PhD and do it at a place like Wisconsin, and where Olaf is. Well, he kind of talked me into it. It was something of interest to me anyway. And that's how I happened to come out here as a student.
Had you lived in this area before?
No. No, I'd been out here at a meeting of the American Society for Engineering Education in 1948, and I think my wife and I had come out, and it was a nice place, and we enjoyed our week out here at the meeting. So I think that helped to get us interested in Wisconsin, too. But I think it was primarily Joel Hogan that got us thinking about this as a possible place to finish up.
Well, then I realize after you got your degree, you didn't go directly into teaching.
No, actually, I went to work for DuPont, the electrochemicals department at DuPont at Niagara Falls. I'd only been there a few weeks when I got called back into the Navy, and I ended up at the Office of Naval Research. I spent about a half a year at DuPont. Then to the Office of Naval Research, where I was a scientific liaison officer. And I worked there for 2 years. I was stationed in Chicago at Michigan Avenue and Randolph Street, which was a long ways from the ocean. But my job there was to see what was going on ONR contracts in the fields of chemistry and some in engineering in the Middle West. And this took me to many of the chemistry and chemical engineering departments in universities, as well as some industries in the middle half of the country. And it was an interesting affair from the point of view that it gave me a lot of contacts, some of which were to be useful later on. And one of the places that I visited on occasions was the University of Wisconsin. And my wife and I decided that we really didn't want to go back east again, and that we liked this part of the country. So instead of going back to DuPont, we thought, well, let's just sort of arbitrarily restrict our looking in the short run anyway, to Wisconsin and Minnesota as being two interesting places. And I was just about to take a job at the Kimberly-Clark up in Neenah, which looked very interesting. And I was up here on business, and mixed a bit of pleasure in with it, had a golf game with Bob Marshall. He said, look, we're interested in starting a solar energy program here. How about coming here and helping us get it started instead of going back to industry? Well, I literally was within hours of, I'd made up my mind, and it was just a matter of sitting down writing a letter to Kimberly-Clark telling him I was coming, but that letter never got written. I came here instead. So my entry into the solar energy field was really started on the golf course.
I was going to ask whether you'd been interested in this area earlier.
Actually, I knew very little about it, except just from very casual reading. So it was a new idea, a new kind of a challenge, very different than what I'd been doing, either for my PhD or for DuPont or for the Navy. But it was an interesting challenge, and the people here were interesting. And, well, I just decided to give it a whirl.
Well, I noticed that the program got underway the year after you, or officially, the year.
Yeah, I came in December of 53. And this followed a meeting. There was in September, I think it was September of 1953, Farrington Daniels organized a symposium here of 20 or so people who were active in the solar energy field, and got some support from NSF for this. The meeting was a small one, but in retrospect, it's one of those things that had implications that were hard to foresee. But he managed to get Bob Marshall and others in the College of Engineering interested in the engineering aspects of this field. And they decided that they would try and develop an engineering program. And so this meeting was in September. It was in the fall that this fortunate golf game with Bob Marshall came along. And very shortly thereafter, I agreed to come here, and did come in December to start up this program. The original program was, I guess, really organized in the experiment station, and it was kind of under the guidance of a committee that included, among others, Jerry Rolick, Bill Sarles, Werner Sumi, and, of course, Farrington Daniels, who was the one that was kind of the spark plug behind the whole thing. Farrington either was or was shortly to become chairman of chemistry, and he was very heavily involved in chemistry. And the first thing I did was to edit the papers that had been presented at the September meeting. I did not go to the September meeting, but I went around to visited the authors of the papers, and that resulted in this book, Solar Energy Research, which was published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 1955. And that was a grand chance to get to know all kinds of interesting people.
Now, you co-edited that with...
Yes, I wrote a summary chapter for it, and actually I did most of the editing. But it included papers by George Lerf, Maria Telkus, and Hoyt Hottel, and quite a number of people who have been active in the field since, and some who, of course, have not been active. But it was a remarkable chance. One of the most remarkable people of all was Charles G. Abbott, who started his scientific career. His first publications were, I think, in 1896 or thereabouts. And he, for decades, was the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. And in 1955, he was still active. As a matter of fact, in 1970, at the tender age of 99, he attended a banquet of the Solar Energy Society and actually got up and spoke for a few minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
And he died just a few months ago at the age of, a couple of years ago, at the age of over 100. Still active and still very much interested in what was going on. Well, this was quite a remarkable introduction to the field for me. I got to know a lot of the... quite a large fraction of the people who were then involved in this field, which was much smaller then than it is now. And the book came out, and we finally got some laboratory space down in what used to be Professor Harlow's Monkey Labs down in the... there's a parking lot and a garden down here now. And then the program was... The inspiration for the program, the early program, was really pretty much Farrington's. And the early history of the solar energy thing here really has to be tied back in with Farrington. He was instrumental. He and I wrote together, but of course he was the key person at that stage of the game, in a proposal that we wrote to the Rockefeller Foundation. And we got very generous funding from them for, I think it was $250,000, which was pretty generous funding at that point, for a four-year program for solar energy applications of potential interest in the developing countries. And this sent us off in a direction that is really quite different than we're following now. We were very much hardware-oriented. We were working on problems that related to a particular segment of the world's population, the people who had very limited resources, and primarily people in climates that were, in some senses, much more favorable for solar energy than the Wisconsin climate, for example. So very different economic and social and physical climates than the things that we're concerned with now. We got involved in quite a number of various aspects of the solar energy field.
What countries did you go to?
Well, we worked primarily in Mexico and to a much less degree in other South American countries and in a very limited sense in Pakistan, Iran, and I don't remember what the others were, but those were the main ones. Some of what we did, I think, in retrospect, as I look back on it, was useful and successful. Other things that we did can best be described as monumental failures in retrospect.
What were your successes?
Well, look, let me talk a little bit about what in one sense was a failure and then go on to something
okay.
that I think was much more interesting. Look, in general, we did a lot of work that laid the groundwork for what we're doing today. And there's no question but what, and in toto, the whole thing was a very worthwhile affair. Pieces of it were, we learned the hard way. Let me review very briefly one area that I think we spent an awful lot of time and effort and funds on that was probably doomed to failure from the beginning and we didn't see it. It's a very intriguing thing to say, look, the people in India burn dung. If they didn't burn dung for cooking, that could be used for fertilizer and the general standard of nutrition would go up and deforestation would be reduced and everything would be improved. They have lots of sun, therefore a solar cooker is the thing that needs to be developed, and if a solar cooker is developed, people in India will use it, and the general welfare of people in that part of the world will be improved. Well, there was some reason to think this might be true. There was a man by the name of Mark Guy. Incidentally, he was author of one of the papers in that solar energy research volume. He'd had a little experience with this and was reasonably optimistic about it. Well, we put a lot of time and effort on it. I think we came up with a piece of hardware that worked like a charm in the laboratory. We developed, in a crude sense, the means of manufacturing these things. We built, over the years, probably upwards of a couple of hundred solar cookers. Many of these we took to Mexico, some to South America, others we sent, we didn't take them, we sent them to Pakistan, to Iran, and a few to some other places. The development of this piece of hardware was primarily the work of a fellow by the name of Dan Dunham. Dan was basically an architect. He was a student at the university, but he was an artist, a designer, a very interesting person. And I think it was really his ideas that were behind this piece of hardware development. Well, we found that we could use these solar cookers in the laboratory with no trouble. People, whenever the sun was out, they could go out and they could cook up bacon and eggs and boil soup and one thing and another on them, no problem. So we made a bunch of these and sent them down to Mexico. And these went to, we worked very closely with the Rockefeller Foundation on this, and we took these to the families of workers on agricultural experiment stations in various parts of the country. These people were not really employees of the foundation, but the foundation sort of ran this agricultural research program for the Mexican government, or in cooperation with the Mexican government. And they had people at each of these stations, and they spoke fluent Spanish and so on. So we these were logical, we thought, places to go to get some good experimental data. We'd give these cookers to these people and show them how to use them and leave them with them and then go back later on and see if they were using them. Well, we did this and we found that we thought that people were using them. We'd go back and sure enough the cooker would come out and it was nice and shiny and worked well and people seemed to know how to use it. And go back and they were there and evidently in use. We were reasonably encouraged. We did a little further evolutionary design work and improved them and so on. And then at one point we got a man to go with us to visit these places who was had been an employee of the foundation and who was himself fluent in Spanish. And he dug a lot deeper into the situation than we did, and he found out that the minute we got out of sight, why these things were very carefully put away and stored. And,
that's why they were so shiny.
That's why they were in such good shape. They hadn't been used at all, and the foreman, the boss of the husband and the family said, you take absolutely good care of this thing. Don't anything happen to it. And then when the people come, you get them out and use them. Well, and if you don't, why, it's your job. All this was just meaningless. Well, Farrington later tried other approaches to this. He tried to develop designs that could be manufactured locally. And I guess I don't really know how well they worked out, but my thought is at this time that the impact of all this was essentially zero. And we spent a lot of time and a lot of money on something that I guess in retrospect taught us that engineers needed to know something about the sociological aspects of this sort of thing, and that we couldn't sit here in Madison and on the basis of some limited experiments by somebody else say a priori we can do this and it will have this result. It just didn't work that way. We did get some better feelings for that aspect of the program by getting together with the anthropology department, with Milt Barnett in anthropology. We got a bit more support from the Rockefeller Foundation for that. And he sent some of his students into the field in southwestern U.S. in an Indian reservation in Arizona, and several people down in Mexico. And these students in anthropology would move in with the villagers and get to know them and so on. Well, nothing very conclusive ever came out of this, and I think that that's another way of saying that nothing conclusive came of it. Nothing came of it. We learned a lot. I guess there were some good theses written. But as far as the impact on the people whose welfare we were working towards, it was essentially zero.
Too much resistance to change.
Too much resistance to change, and in Mexico, people knew that the men shuffled back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico working in agricultural jobs, and they knew full well that people didn't use these things here, so why should they use them down there? And there's just all kinds of social problems. Well, in retrospect, I think we did expend a very large amount of resources on something that really was, if we'd been smarter, we just wouldn't have done that. This actually extended over a period of 6 or 7 years, and I said earlier that the Rockefeller Foundation gave us a grant for 4 years. Well, actually they gave us a series of 3 grants, which covered a span of about 11 years. So we were very handsomely supported by the foundation. And the total of those grants was between $700,000 and $800,000. So in the 1950s and early 60s, that went a long way.
That's handsome support.
Yes. We were involved in a number of other things. We did some of the early work on absorption cooling. And this had two aspects to it. The first was the use of intermittent coolers for household refrigeration. In other words, you can make a machine that is very simple to manufacture, but as it turns out, fairly complicated to operate, which is quite inexpensive and which can keep a 3 or 4 cubic foot ice box cold, a refrigerator box. It requires mechanical manipulation for a couple hours each day. It's the sort of thing that people around here wouldn't think twice about doing. They just wouldn't do it. On the other hand, if there was some real advantage to being able to cool food in Mexico, for example, we thought again that maybe this would be something that people would be interested in. Well, in some senses, that work took the same sort of path as the solar cooker work. We built and sent down to a student, one of the anthropology students that was living in a village near Torreon, a machine that we had used with success in the laboratory. It was a solar operated refrigeration machine, which we knew worked. There was just no question about it. Our people in the laboratory had kept a box cool with it as long as we had good weather. But the people, even this anthropologist, who was a very clever fellow, a first-class mechanic and so on, he couldn't make this thing work. And we had telephone calls and correspondence back and forth, and finally one of the engineers from the lab went down there, and the thing worked like a charm. But so the basic problem with the thing turned out to be that it was conceptually simple, but from the point of view of manipulation of the thing, it was complicated. It really wasn't complicated if you understood it, but you had to understand it to make it go. And there's just no way that this sort of thing was going to have any impact. I think there's a serious question, too, on a household scale, whether whether the introduction of refrigeration into a society that basically doesn't have it is going to have any impact, except over a very long period of time. The first thing that people will do will be to cool Coca-Cola. That's the idea of refrigerating meat, I think, is a pretty foreign idea. And again, the social aspects of the thing were just beyond us. But I feel much better about that cooling development for a couple of reasons. First of all, it got us into something that we should have been in, I suppose, earlier in the piece anyway, namely some more basic engineering studies of how those systems worked, how they should be designed, and also what kinds of systems from the point of view of refrigerant and absorbent, what kinds of systems could be used, whether you ought to stick with ammonia water or go to something else. So that the experience with those machines, while the field work, I think, was unproductive, we learned a lot about cooling, and that was our introduction to topics that are of very lively interest here today. So that was not at all wasted. It also suggested to us something that people still don't agree with today, but I think it's true, that if you're going to work on solar energy applications in the developing countries, you're probably much better off working on community scale applications rather than household scale. If you want to provide people with refrigeration, probably the best way to go at it is to put somebody in business in an ice manufacturing facility where you can train a couple of people to run a facility that will make a ton of ice a day or something like that, and distribute the ice and do things in a way that the engineering is better, because you can do things better on a somewhat larger scale, and you get away from the problems of trying to make all the housewives and engineers. Well, the third thing that happened out of that solar cooling study was that we started work on continuous absorption cooling. And we did this in a couple of different ways. The idea here really was to refrigeration on a much larger scale, warehouse refrigeration, which again I think is the way to go on this. And we actually got into two different aspects of this. One, we tried to design and build an experimental absorption air conditioner for the laboratory.
Well, here you mean?
Yeah, the old lab down here. Well, we never really succeeded with that, but we learned an awful lot about it, and we finally got a hold of a commercial absorption air conditioner, which could be adapted for that purpose. And we actually, I think, did one of the earliest, possibly not the earliest, but one of the earliest experiments on solar operation of absorption air conditioners down in the old laboratory. And that was done back in, it must have been the late 50s, early 60s. And the ideas there are ones that are being exploited today. So out of all of this work that we did under Rockefeller Foundation sponsorship, a lot of it didn't achieve the objective of helping the people in developing countries. And in that sense, from the foundation's point of view, it really didn't do the job. On the other hand, from an academic point of view, and now from a practical point of view, there was a great deal accomplished. We learned an awful lot about materials, we learned how to analyze equipment, we learned how to do a lot of experiments. We developed a background that when the crunch started to come in this country, put us in a marvelous position to move. And we had a background developed that was very good indeed, and we were ready to go in 1971. Also, I think we developed a lot of useful information that is being used not only by ourselves but by other people. And in a sense, that's what the university is supposed to be doing, is not going out and trying to solve all the world's day-to-day problems, but developing the information and the expertise and so on to permit these kinds of problems to be solved. So, in some ways, I feel very good about that whole effort of the Rockefeller Foundation. In other ways, from their point of view, I think the thing was less than successful.
Well, even they may reassess it.
according to the current problems with
energy.
I haven't talked to anybody there for quite a while. I guess if I was going to start the solar program over again, if I could go back and do it over, I probably would do things a little bit differently. We were very strongly experimentally oriented. We had very little theoretical and analytical capability to go with the experiments, and I think we overdid that part of it. Now, in a sense, we may be going in the other direction. We're almost entirely analytical and theoretical and computational, with possibly not enough experiments, but I think our program here is pretty good now. Well, we got involved with some very interesting and productive people in this span, and the people are part of history.
Yes, they certainly are.
Might be worth mentioning a few of them. We made an arrangement with Dr. George Lerf, who was basically a consulting engineer in Denver, but George had been in the solar energy field since about 1944, when he had done some experiments during the last part of World War II, when the nation was faced with a problem that's similar to that today. It looked like fuel was going to be tough and a long war ahead, and we better think about alternatives to the conventional ones. So he got into a study of house heating back in the early 40s, and he was still active in this. And over the years, he worked part-time for us. A quarter time or less for the total period of the Rockefeller program, for 11 or 12 years. And this was a very productive and interesting cooperation. We did have a little experimental facility out at Denver. We did some of the cooling experiments out there, and we also did another experimental program out there, some rather basic studies of energy balances on focusing collectors. Well, they were experimental, but at the time they were about the only quantitative experiments that were available on this whole class of collectors. Well, we don't think these collectors are particularly interesting, but nevertheless, at least we know what kinds of questions to ask about them and what kinds of problems are involved. But this, I think, was an extremely worthwhile effort. Actually, we had a young man by the name of Dale Fester who did a master's program as a part of this, but he got his master's degree from Denver University while working on a University of Wisconsin program on the top of the Farmers Union building parking lot in downtown Denver. George has been and still is a valued colleague and friend, and it was an association that was very valuable indeed. We did get into some more fundamental sorts of things, the nature of selective surfaces. These are surfaces that have a high absorptance for solar energy and a low emittance for long wave energy. We had a very fine student by the name of Duane Williams who did his PhD on this. And that work didn't attract much attention at the time it was done. It was published, I've forgotten when, but it was 15 years ago perhaps. Again, this is something that people have gotten back to. Some of the same ideas that are in Duane's work are being looked at again. So in a sense, that was a bit ahead of its time. We had a man here by the name of Ray Chung, C-H-U-N-G, who did a lot of the cooling work. And he was the one who did, well, he did most of the cooling experiments. He did, was really responsible for the original absorption air conditioning studies in the old laboratory. We had a lot of very good students. And it was an interesting 11 or 12 years. In that span of time, there was very little thought given to the possibilities of solar energy applications in this country. There just wasn't any particular reason to think about this. Energy was so cheap that there was just no incentive. And essentially all of the attention, the little bit of attention that was being given to solar energy during that period, say from 55 to 65, was primarily focused on developing countries. Just to illustrate the magnitude of the program, we added up one time the total amount of funds that we thought were going into solar energy per year during those years.
This is around the country.
Around the country. And compared it to the annual budget of the AEC for atomic energy research, and decided that the solar energy budget would keep the AEC going for about 5 minutes. This was about the ratio of the national investment in these two fields, 1 year to 5 minutes. So it was a pretty low level of effort. We knew everybody in the field. If anybody was working in it, we knew them. Well, I think in retrospect, it's a very good thing indeed that there were some people who were doing this. And I think this is very much to the Rockefeller Foundation's credit. NSF, they put a little money into it in a few studies. We had a little study here. There was an NSF project out at UCLA that was a very, very good one. There's a few small ones around, because this small collection of programs was the springboard from which the present rather substantial solar energy efforts were launched. And I think in retrospect it was was really too bad that there wasn't a more organized and, or perhaps, or more vigorous solar energy program, even a small one over those years, because, well, even today there's an awful lot of rediscovery of the wheel, because everybody wants to get cranked up at the same time. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Along with the work on solar refrigeration and cooking, we got into another problem area that was an interesting one. One of the, well, everybody's heard about solar cells that convert solar energy directly to electrical energy. And the problem with these things from practical aspects is that the cost of energy from them is roughly 100 times the cost of energy from conventional sources. Now, the ratio isn't that high today, but it was then. But here was something that mechanically was so simple, no moving parts, that that in the lifetime looked like it would be long, and it'd be simple to use, and low maintenance, which is critical in the solar field, that this is something that there ought to be a way to reduce the cost of energy coming from these things. Well, there are two basic approaches that have been taken to this, one of which we were active in early, the other which we were in no position to be active in. Well, the second of these is the development of cells themselves. We did, our people were all mechanical and chemical engineers, and we had no capabilities in the cell development field. So we took what we could obtain from the cell manufacturers. But there's another aspect of this, and that is we could increase the radiation intensity on cells by optical means and boost the output of the cells. You double the intensity radiation, you don't quite double the output, but you don't come too far from it. So, we decided that we would have a look at what would be the design criteria, how you would go about building a small power system that would run not at 2 or 3 times the normal solar intensity, but maybe 2 or 300 times. And in fact, we got a small contract from the Signal Corps and built for them a pilot model of a concentrator and solar cell power system operating at high fluxes. And again, the thing, it really worked, it was kind of a neat machine, I think. We, about that time, Bill Beckman, this was about 1963, Bill Beckman joined us. He was a new PhD from the University of Michigan. One of the best things we ever did was to hire him, because he's a phenomenal guy. But he came in and he did a lot of heat transfer work on this. And we did develop and deliver to the Signal Corps a piece of hardware that was a not an economical producer of power, but not so far from it as a lot of other people were doing. And again, the basic idea that we worked on there is being exploited today by others. And the work that we did, I think, was laid a lot of the groundwork for programs that are now going on, not here, but elsewhere. So, that aspect of the program was fruitful in these two ways. It brought Bill Beckman here, and it also provided some interesting groundwork for programs that are now going on. Now, in 1953, I had been here, or in 63, I had been here for 10 years, and I had an opportunity to go away for a year on a Fulbright to the University of Queensland in Australia, which I did. I worked with Norman Sheridan there. He'd had some experience in solar cooling and had done a lot of thinking about it and a little writing. And this was a very interesting year. It was a tremendously satisfying experience from a personal point of view, and also as it turned out, professionally, too. We got involved in an experiment there, I did, that was, in some respects, quite like the one here. But it was a planned development of an experimental program, including heating and cooling and a building, and done in a much more planned fashion than the experiments that we had done. And we developed some analytical capabilities while I was there that were just be quite valuable later on. And the other thing that happened there, just by coincidence, the mechanical engineering department at the University of Queensland obtained during my stay there a very fine analog computer. And Keith Bullock, the man who was responsible for that operation, said, look, you ought to be able to analyze the solar processes on this thing. We gave it some thought and decided, yes, there really were some possibilities. And we did some simulations on that analog of simple solar heating systems. And it was obvious that here indeed was a powerful tool. A new analytical tool that would really be quite useful in understanding how things work in these processes. Nothing's ever steady in a solar energy process. The sun's getting brighter or dimmer, the loads on the house are going up or down, or the hot water is on or off, or the power is needed or not needed, and they're transient operations. No matter what you're doing, there's just nothing ever steady. So there are real problems in trying to make sense out of the long-term operation. Well, this very early work on simulations at Queensland, in a way, was the forerunner of what is now a major program here. Incidentally, I had some salary support to supplement my Fulbright and Guggenheim from the Alumni Research Foundation, from WARF, through the graduate school, and that made it possible for me to go. And in retrospect, the funds that were expended by WARF have had remarkable long-term implications. They've helped to put us into a major ongoing program that has been very productive indeed. Well, the trip to Australia was very good, I think. It made lots of contacts, and we've had lots of contacts with Australia ever since. We've had a steady stream of people back and forth. Bill Beckman spent a year in Melbourne after that. We've had Don Close from CSIRO in Melbourne has spent a year here. Shortly after I came back, we've had other people from Australia here. And all this was sort of in the, what I sometimes refer to as the first phase of the solar energy program, sort of the up to 1965. Well, from 1965 till 70 or 71, it was very difficult indeed to do anything in the solar energy field.
Funding was
non-existent. The Rockefeller Foundation had been generous in the extreme with us. It supported us for 11 years. We had a few little bits and pieces, but gee, for that 6 years or so in there, and not only our program, but all over the country, there were just no funds for anything in the solar field. Interest in the developing countries had waned because it was obvious that, well, to put it bluntly, that solar energy processes were capital intensive. You had to have capital. You had to buy in the beginning to save operating costs. And the thing that was in biggest shortage in the developing countries and still is capital. So there's a fundamental incompatibility. And the incentive to look at it from the point of view of developing countries wasn't here because you could buy natural gas or oil or what have you for a price that was far below what you could expect to deliver solar energy. So there was no incentive, and there was a solar energy has had a history of ups and downs. Well, we really had our downs in the 65 to 70, 71.
Did the development of our work on atomic energy have something to do with this?
Well, I think that the development of atomic energy was shaped by very different forces than those that had to do with solar. For example, in 1945, after the bomb had been exploded in New Mexico and after the two bombs had been exploded in Japan, there was very strong public support for peacetime uses of the atom. There was a huge nationwide constituency and also a huge industrial constituency. The companies that had invested or through government or whatever means there were in the development of nuclear energy, there was just a huge consistency pushing for the development of atomic energy, even though the prospects at that point for atomic energy are probably probably not much better than the prospects for solar energy today. And the problems were more formidable, and but the constituency was there to make atomic energy go, and that's a very strong difference. There has never been a constituency, or there never was a constituency, supporting the development of solar energy prior to, say, 1971 or 72.
Took the energy crunch.
It took the OPEC countries pushing the price of oil up and threatening to withhold oil to boost energy prices and start this nation looking around for some alternatives. Now there's a constituency for solar. In fact, it may be a more vocal one than that for atomic energy. Although the resources going into solar are still very small compared to what's going into atomic energy. Well, what did we do during that period? The two of us who were on the permanent staff during that period in the lab were Bill Beckman and myself. Bill got deeply involved in working with Warren Porter and John Mitchell. Warren is in zoology, and they were working on energy balances on animals. Warren had money from the National Science Foundation, and they were able to develop a means of predicting what the animal, some kinds of animals' temperatures would be, and what he would do as a result of the thermal situation. The thing that the particular animal they were working on was a desert lizard, and they could predict where he would be at various times. And the long-term objective of the zoologists in this was to know enough about the animals so that they could predict what the predator and prey interactions would be. You know what the prey is doing, you know what the predator is doing, you can say how these things interact. Well, and particularly in desert climates, radiation has a lot to do with this. Well, that's one of the things that Bill was doing. He also had a student, Steve Sargent, who worked on energy balances in the atmosphere. This was a problem that Reed Bryson proposed that had to do with long-wave radiation exchange and how deserts cool and so on. And he also had a very fine student by the name of Yahya Hamid from Sudan who did a study of a particular kind of solar air heater. Now, the study was done only in part tied in with solar heaters. It was a rather fundamental study, but it was solar in some respects. And I did something else. I was asked if I would take on the job of being director of the University Industry Research Program. And I did that on a half or three-quarter time basis. And as a part of that, I was an associate dean of the graduate school. Well, I was at UIR for, I guess, 5 or 6 years, and spent a lot of effort in developing that program. So Bill and I were, both of us, we kept the Solar Energy Laboratory alive, but it was not a very vigorous operation. It was a pretty low level. Farrington, by that time, had retired from chemistry, and he came over and was an honored guest in the laboratory. He was never the director of the laboratory. There's some misconception about that. He was, during the early years of the laboratory, he was chairman of the chemistry department, and that's a very large, very vigorous, and superb department, in large measure, substantial measure, due to his efforts. And he used to spend a bit of time with us, and he was pretty much in those years in the role of an advisor to the laboratory, but he didn't really play a particularly active role in it, except as a source of inspiration and advice. The program was really in engineering. After he retired from chemistry, we made a space in the laboratory for him, which he carried out a number of experiments and did the things that were of interest to him. And I think this was a very nice arrangement for everybody. But actually throughout the history of the laboratory, with the exception of the year I was away, I actually had been the director and responsible for the operation of it. Well, we had these dry years of no funding. And I don't remember the exact dates right offhand, but in about 1970, things started to stir again. And Bill and I started to give some thought to what we wanted to do if the opportunity should arise to revive the solar program. We made some plans, and I think it was in 1971, we made our move, so to speak. We wrote our first proposal to the National Science Foundation, to the RAND program, the Research Applied to National Needs. And we got funded. Now, the work that we chose to take on was the development of methods of simulating solar heating and cooling processes. In other words, what we tried to do was to develop the capability of predicting how these transient processes would behave over long periods of time, over short periods or long periods. And we wanted to do this basically by computational techniques. Well, the first study that we actually did with this, we had two students, Gutierrez and Hincape, two students from South America, one an electrical engineer and the other a chemical engineer, who did a study on a hybrid computer down on the 10th floor, which was a far more detailed and complex study, but along the same basic lines that Norm Sheridan and Keith Bullock and I had done in Brisbane. But we went far beyond anything we'd been able to do in Brisbane. There we were very much limited on the one hand by our own experience with the thing, on the other by the capabilities of the machine they had there. But the one here, the hybrid, is a much more powerful machine. Well, we did quite a number of simulations of a month's operation of several different kinds of water heating systems. And this was kind of our first effort at getting back into things. It was a pretty good takeoff study. We got rather quickly decided that we were going to have to go to digital computing, and the analog was not fast enough. And the second effort, actually we, must be just 4 years ago now, that we had three new students come in. And these were notable students. I think they're worth recording. Well, two of them were. One was a chap by the name of Larry Butts. And Larry did an absolutely superb master's thesis in mechanical engineering on simulation of a solar heating and cooling system. And a number of people that have looked at that thesis said it would have been a good doctor's thesis in a lot of places. It's one that we're really quite proud of. He did a very thorough simulation study. There had been other simulation studies done before. There's one done at Ohio State, actually, that George Lerf and Dick Tybaugh down there had been involved in. And another one, the other main one, was out at UCLA. But none of these had been done in the detail and care that Larry did. And he predicted the long-term performance of a solar heated and air-conditioned building and using some meteorological data that we had for Albuquerque. We used to call this the Albuquerque building. In fact, we talked about the Albuquerque building so much that I was down talking to Women's Day one time and talking about the Albuquerque building and how it performed and all this. And afterwards, one of the people in the audience came up and said, "I'm going to Albuquerque next week. Could you give me the address of this? I want to go see it." Well, I had to tell her that this thing existed only in the computer down on Dayton Street. We had to be careful how we talked about this. But Larry's thesis was a monumental effort. It's the sort of thing we do in hours now, but 4 years ago it was just a tremendous effort. And it really got us into a program that I'll come back to in just a minute. The other student that came in then was Sandy Klein. Larry was from Green Bay. Sandy was our forerunner. He came from Chicago. Really, really fine student who just 2 days ago got his PhD. So he's a rare student who has established for himself an international reputation and has a whole string of publications before his thesis ever got finished.
My word.
He's quite a remarkable fellow. Well, we'll come back to Sandy's work because that's really interesting. But the next step in the modern program, the second phase of our program, after Larry Butts, Rod Auk, another Wisconsin student, most of our students lately have been from Wisconsin. We got involved with Colorado State University in the development of an experiment. They built out at CSU an experimental building with a solar heating and cooling system on it. Well, we'd been involved in these cooling studies for some time, and we had the capabilities of doing some simulations. So Rod took on the job of doing simulations as a part of the process of designing that solar heating and cooling system for Fort Collins. And his starting point was Larry Butts' thesis. And we made a few changes in the system, and it took Rod months to get these, to do the new simulations. We thought it was going to be a trivial thing, but it wasn't. Well, this led us into a whole new area of how to devise the means of simulating systems that are different but with a minimum of effort and in a way that people can change things easily. And Sandy Klein was the primary author, although a dozen people have contributed to it, a program called TRANSYS, T-R-N-S-Y-S, standing for Transient Systems. And this is sort of the standard solar process simulation program for the country now. We've sent out about 200 copies of this. And an awful lot of people that are doing simulations are doing them using the programs that our students have developed. Sandy Klein being the main driving force in that. Now, at this stage, during these developments, Farrington became ill. And his real driving spirit behind all this was due to his experience, based on his experience during the war, when he participated in the Manhattan Project. I think he had very strong humanitarian feelings about the fact that he had participated in something that was basically destructive.
The bomb.
I think he was, I've heard him express himself on this. I don't know what the best word to describe it, but frightened or aghast at the implications of what they had accomplished, along with a lot of other people involved, I gather. And he decided that he wanted to devote the rest of his life to doing something that was clearly useful and would improve people's welfare. That's my interpretation of his feeling.
Well, I do know that when he retired, after his retirement, his principal interest was the solar energy.
Yeah, it was. And his interest was very much focused on the developing countries. He remained to the end a devoted, really, to this idea. And in some ways, he and I had fundamental disagreements in the sense that he thought we ought to be working towards the developing countries and devoting our efforts in this direction, and the problems that were of most interest to Bill and I were, what do we do about solar energy in this country? And it's been suggested many times that you let the rich pay for the Cadillacs, and after a while Chevys are built and the poor can have them too. And that if solar energy gets established in the industrial countries, that's probably the best way for it to become more widely used in the developing countries. But Farrington really never had much interest in the kinds of work we've been doing here in the last 5 years. To the end, he really thought that the best way of going in the solar energy field was to for applications in the developing countries. So he never really participated in the modern phase of the program. But even though we diverged in this sense, I think that he's really made his mark in a couple of ways. He inspired a lot of people. There's no question about that. He was a spokesman for solar energy at a time when spokesmen were few and far between, and particularly when people who had any influence and stature in the scientific community, most of the people just weren't interested, and he was it. So he performed an invaluable service there. It's also interesting to note that